she inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Gina Murphy, darling, and you are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World, a fun and informative place where we never tell you what to think, we just want you to. Thanks so much for joining us and for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. Also, a big thanks to the Fairfax companies, true leaders in the business of sustainability and responsible for preventing thousands of tons of green and post-construction waste from going into our landfills every year. They are the sponsor of this show. They are great supporters of Mrs. Green's World and our mission and vision. And to learn more about them and their important work, please consider visiting them at thefairfaxcompanies.com. Thank you, Jason and company, for stepping up almost 10 years ago and saying, we're going to support this mission. You know, I want to take a deep breath here and kind of calm myself down because I am so excited about this show. It's almost goofy. The name of our show today is Callie and Rama, the artist and the artist elephant. And we have never had a show like this. I'm not even sure how to introduce the guests for this next hour because I really am that excited to share our story. So Callie O'Neill, welcome. And I'm going to do my best to give you the intro that you deserve.
Mahalo nui. Aloha, Mrs. Green.
Aloha. So you know where she is. She's in Hawaii. I met Callie at the wonderful and impactful Bioneers Conference that I get to attend each year. And as soon as she told me her story, it was even magical the way that we met. I was totally hooked and cannot wait to share Callie O'Neill with all of you. So please join me in welcoming her. And I just want to give you a little bit of a intro about what your work is and the scope of it and how highly respected you are throughout the world. Callie is from the island of Hawaii and is a highly respected, well-known muralist, visionary conservation and cultural artist, social ecologist, social fine art designer, and community facilitator. In short, Callie is a prolific artist, designer with a long-term, broad range of creative experience. Journalists have described her as a wayfinder, a force of nature, a positive force, and a wise woman, praising her art as ethno-visionary, dynamic, and breathtaking, with a crystalline mastery of glaze painting, light, and color. And if you visit her website, it'll take you about a nanosecond to see exactly why that is written about her. Thus, my excitement in sharing her with all of you and my desire to go visit her, Callie. Hint, hint. I hope it's on my bucket list sooner than later. Oh my gosh, it is one of my favorite places on earth, Hawaii and all its magic. So Callie, I like to start the way I like to start every show. I'd like to start. Share a bit with us about your journey to becoming an artist, not just about this project. And I ask that because I believe there are so many people who have the artist within, but have not acted on it and their dreams and let that, you know, unravel, let alone create a beautiful and successful world around your art. So tell us a bit about your journey to becoming an artist.
Oh, thank you so much. Actually, only recently I've been starting to think about that. And I had this, you know, how we have experiences, even if powerful, and then we might forget them for a while and then we come back. Well, I had this vision recently of exactly what this book cover or book report cover looked like that I did on beige oak tag. And I think I must have been in sixth or seventh or eighth grade. And it said in handwriting, India. And I had drawn the head of an elephant, an Indian elephant.
You were kidding me. What?
Really amazing. Given that I wound up working and dedicating my life to Rama, the elephant, who's an Asian elephant. And I drew this Asian elephant. And I distinctly remember I drew it freehand, as I do. All my drawings are all freehand always. And I looked at that drawing as a middle schooler and I thought, oh, how amazing. I can draw. I can draw and I can design. It was well placed in the page. It was kind of large. I actually have been, had this passion the past couple of weeks. Like, I'm going to reproduce that drawing because I don't have it. And only recently I have been looking at the influences because people ask, and I didn't really know. I just follow, you know, I follow guidance and intuition, inspiration and meditation. And so I've been looking at these influences and realizing they're very clear, you know, what brought me to the design place I'm in and the thinking place. My grandpa was a handsome, beautiful, old Italian grandpa, born and raised in Italy, moved to the United States when he was young. And he had a kind of an edible landscape, which I got way into. And I got way into later in the design work. And he had everything that, you know, he had a little grape arbor and he taught me humus, what compost was, because nobody else cared. And I got way into life and the soil and how important it was. He had peppers and tomatoes and all the Italian herbs and his tiny greenhouse. He made all of this out of recycled materials. And he was a photographer, so he was an artist, gardener, designer. And people used to come, all the weddings came to Grandpa's house, this four-layered suburban, cool little village townhouse, to have their pictures taken in front of his azaleas.
I love it.
And yeah, and I became like Grandpa. And there's key influences of my work that I've only now started to look at and appreciate and be fascinated by the journey. And one was that I've always loved churches, and I'm deeply saddened now that churches are locked around the world.
Right, right.
You know, we used to go into churches, and I would go into any holy place and just walk in and sit down. I would go straight to the front and realize somehow that, you know, billions and billions of prayers had been prayed in these places, and just love the stained glass and the marble and the beauty and the sculptures, which, you know, as a girl growing up in a pure white little town in New Jersey, I didn't see too much of, except for our own church was really beautiful as well. So that seemed to be my museum, you know, my
right.
museum to go into churches. So I loved stained glass, and I've come to work with stained glass, but it's not like I thought about that. I just let the light pour through the colored glass and come into me, and somehow it affected me. Then the minute I saw illuminated manuscripts, I was so attracted to them when I finally had the chance when I was in college, and later I used to travel to Washington, D.C. and go to all the museums as I did in my home city of New York City. And I remember when I got to spend time in the Rare Books Library in the Library of Congress, the collection included illuminated manuscripts. And I would walk in, they would give me white gloves and a red velvet set of beanbag weights and ask me what illuminated manuscript I wanted to see. And I was allowed to draw them. And I did, and I was fascinated by borders and the millefiori, the beautiful flowers and the meaning and the fact that within that structure of illuminated manuscripts, many aspects of a story could be designed in a way that's not just a montage. It's this really magnificent and ingenious division of space.
And let me just ask you, let me just press pause here for a minute, because I think you should explain what an illuminated manuscript is. I think I understand it. Isn't it the text and all the beautiful things drawn around it? What is an illuminated manuscript?
Yes, thank you. Well, the manuscript is the text, and the illuminations are these gorgeous paintings, which are almost always highly detailed, quite small.
Works
of art.
They were
literally making books, works of art.
Yes.
Every page is a journey, and they always had the enlarged first letter of the text, and there were beasts and plants and animals wrapped around that first letter. And I mean, the letter would only be an inch high or something, an inch and a half high. And every page, I mean, throughout the Middle East and Europe, I mean, artists went blind doing these things. And some kind of happily went blind in service of these works of art. But they were beautiful, and they took me on a great journey. And then I was drawing all the time. And then when I was in high school, this actually is prior to the Illuminated Manuscript journey, I heard someone in school or was taught by a teacher, I don't recall who, told me there was such a thing as endangered species. And I was very disturbed by that.
Right.
And I really did not understand. I did not understand what those two words meant. Maybe I was too humble or shocked or embarrassed to ask, I didn't understand what that meant or how that was even remotely possible.
Right.
And then I found out that humans were the cause of this endangerment, because paleontologists tell us that, you know, throughout time, as they have studied it through fossil records, there is one species per million created. One species per, hold on, wait a minute. That's one species per million is created. You know, it's just a very rare thing that a new species is created.
Right.
And then
right.
the background extinction is that same, just one species, you know. In all of the species, it's a very small amount, you know, one species per million per year. And so this is a very low level of creation and extinction once life was established. And now it's like 1,000 times that much. So I stopped drawing all people. I used to love drawing people and faces and lips and I completely stopped drawing people. And I literally stopped liking people. I love my family. I love my friends. I love my community. But on the whole, this great kind of disrespect and distrust that was just, it didn't play out in unhappiness or anything, but it was just a background misunderstanding. Nobody was really there to help me. We didn't have internet in those days.
I know, it's hard to believe, right? We think we always had the internet, but we always didn't. It was not until the 90s, which is, I think, what was life without internet? I can't remember.
Right, I mean, I remember because we owned Encyclopedia Britannica.
I know. It was a way people made their living. I know. Everybody had an Encyclopedia Britannica. That will become obsolete. There are... younger generation will have no idea what that is. They'll have to go to the internet to find out what it even was.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, maybe it didn't even say endangered species. I didn't know what to do except start drawing animals.
Right, right.
And that's all I would draw. And I got way into animals. And then I would combine the animals in kind of strange ways, but very refined, detailed drawings and animals upon animals. Then I heard of this art form called mandalas, these magic circles.
Oh my gosh, magic,
you know,
yes.
Of wholeness, you know. And I for 7 years, I did only mandalas. So
what
when I took
a dive, yeah.
Looking back, when I took a dive, I mean, I really took a dive into an aspect of art history or artists or genres or media. And so I got way into mandalas, and then animals started to play into my mandalas, and then words, you know, sayings about transformation and awakening, and before I had any real spiritual knowledge or journeying, you know. And then I realized that, there's some art that's public, and then there's a whole range of art that's private and just for the wealthy, and I didn't have a whole lot of interest in that. My interest has been, since whenever I heard of it, public art, like
right.
art that's for everybody, art that's accessible, art that has meaning, art that has power. And my basic contention, Gina, is that art must have power again. And the power got removed from art. So I bumped into, like, moving along, and now I'm went through Pratt Institute in New York, summa
right.
cum laude. And then I went into, I literally like fell into by destiny, a social ecology program, the first ever in a master's level at Goddard College. And I found out about public art and especially the Mexican mural masters. And I realized they had a whole lot to say and it was powerful. And I started to study them in detail, every one of them. And the minute I had my first mural commission in Honolulu, I literally took the money I made and went to Mexico. And for months, just every single day, all day, 8-10 hours, drew a mural freehand, like 150 figures in Diego Rivera mural in like an 11 by 14 piece of paper. And I would just sit there and from one corner to the other, in complete detail, draw these murals. And I got to be amazingly good at drawing. I mean, I could draw anything, look at it, always, you know, priding myself on that it was freehand and that drawing is the basis of everything, aside from a really keen design sense.
Right.
And that I loved these artists, Gina, these Mexican mural masters. And then I started to study the social realists like Kate DeColvitz. And then I bumped into this street artist researcher's work by the name of Eva Cockcroft. And she put forth, I don't know what to call it, a philosophy, a statement of fact, whatever we want to call it, that abstract expressionism and the rise of abstractionism, especially as it started in New York, my home city, in the United States, it's really the only huge art movement that started in New York, or the major one in any case, and that there was no content, and that the major museums that were coming forth, MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney, the Guggenheim,
right,
the Getty, you know, so many contemporary art museums were selecting the art and the artists and paying for the art that had no content at all.
I so get it. It was just a pretty picture. Yes, a pretty picture is what they were paying.
Or not even pretty.
You know,
it could be whatever. And, you know, with all respect to all the abstract art lovers out there listening and the abstract artists, you know, I love art. I love so many different kinds of art. I do have respect for abstract artists, but
yes,
it is worth saying that the content got pulled, and that was both great for artists, totally free of all the old, you know, academy works and figures and, you know, the rules and regulations and proportions and, you know, guidelines, and they were free, and that was great. And it was pure expression, emotional expression, color, light, and movement, color field, you know, experimentation of what happens when I do, you know, a red stripe and a blue stripe and another red stripe.
Right,
what
right.
Amethyst aqua blue. And, you know, going through Pratt, one has to get fully immersed in this because teachers were all super progressive, especially the painters, which I was not into painting, by the way.
Right.
In those days at all. I never thought I would be a painter at all. And I really studied this, and I started to become acutely aware of this. And Eva Cockcroft's contention was that this was deliberate, that the elite know that when art is powerful, and all blessings and regards to the 1% as well, you know,
right,
it's really important that they awaken to all of this, too, to support the artists and all the conservationists and healers and light workers at this time. And so these museums literally took the power out of art in her way of thinking. And this became a major part of my master's degree thesis, because I could feel that when art has no content, no meaning, who can relate to that? How many people do we really know on Main Street, in the suburbs, throughout the United States, care about that? You know, it's a kind of, I've gone to with a couple of people, especially in my family, that I laughed all the way through shows because the young guys with me were hilariously dialoguing and narrating what these paintings were about. You know, it's like people can't relate to it. Well, that was the idea. You know, if nobody can relate to art, if it has no power and meaning, well, there went the most important and powerfully effective mode of communicating to people.
Okay, we are, believe it or not, we are at the first break. Oh my gosh. When we come back, Callie and Rama, the artist and the artist elephant, and we will start talking about the exhibition and Callie's relationship with Rama. Please stay here with me.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I am Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks so much for joining us. With us this hour is Callie O'Neill, a prolific artist, designer with a long-term, broad range of creative experience, which we've been hearing about in the first segment. Her groundbreaking collaboration with Rama, the elephant artist, toward a worldwide traveling exhibition is nothing short of epic. In her works, her planetary vision is incorporated into ecological fine art that stands on its own merits and also serves the purpose of nourishing the earth and all of its inhabitants. As a citizen of the planet, Callie is committed to help create a future that is even better than the one that we can imagine, and so she is. Trust me on that one. So, Callie, I want to make sure that we cover what happened with Rama, so we need to fast forward a little bit, I think, because I am so into the journey, but you had such a rich and robust and strong foundation for what was about to be created through this exhibit. So where do you want to start on that one?
Well, the natural result of all my interests, although it wasn't conscious, was intuitive, was the study of ecology and my master's degree in social ecology at Goddard. And so I became immersed in wanting to help the living skin of Earth, biosphere, which is really important to note, Gina, that if you take the onion, the outermost crisp brown skin of an onion, and you just have picture one-tenth of that.
Right.
That is analogous to the living film, the mantle of life on Earth called the biosphere. From the deepest oceans to the highest atmosphere where there's oxygen and where a bird can fly, that is how thin that membrane of life is.
Right.
So I was on the beach one day, and after this vision of I want to meet an abstract expressionist and work on a traveling exhibition on endangered peoples of the world, because they and their languages and immense knowledge is disappearing. And I asked this gentleman, whose abstract works I like, he was vacationing there, and he said, no way, there is no way I'm going to let you show me up. And I was like, okay, I understand that, but I wasn't about to show you up, just harmonize. And years later, I had forgotten that memory, and my son called to me when we were at the Oregon Zoo, a rare visit by having had a profound effect of the Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle. And he said, come running. He knew I loved elephants. Something cool is happening here. So I ran as fast as I could, and we wound up in front of this huge glass window in the elephant barn. And there was this elephant, Rama, painting with this creative, innovative keeper, Jeb, working on an easel, painting the most beautiful little abstract painting that I had ever seen. Gorgeous. Oh. And my heart started pounding. My skin started tingling. I have full body experience. I remember squeezing Noah's arms and looking at them, and this overwhelming vision that blocked out any possible, critical thinking right. about the practicality of what I was about to dive into. Nothing came in, no filters, just I have to work with them. That's it. Like, I was going one way, I saw this elephant paint with his breath. He was spray painting. This has never been done by another elephant, and it probably won't be done again. I mean, it's just not, they don't care. Elephants don't care to do this. Rama liked it. You know, Jeb had, he had set about to have Rama stop spraying the keeper's legs. Rama was born and raised in the Oregon Zoo.
Okay.
His father, Packy, was the first Indian elephant that had ever been born in the North American continent in like 50 years. I mean, he was basically the first Indian elephant to start a whole family, a genealogy. And Rama was his son. And, you know, Packy was big and handsome and 5,000 pounds more than Rama's 8,500 pounds. And Rama needed to thrive. He needed this, what's called, you know, emotional and mental stimulation in it's called enrichment programs. So Jeb thought, well, I'm going to teach him and ask him to stop spraying us in the legs with water. And then he got this flash that, well, why don't I just put some of my children's non-toxic watercolor paint, this tempera, in his beak, the tip of his trunk, which is like 300 pounds.
Right.
A little tiny bit of paint, a little bit of non-toxic paint goes a very long way if an elephant blasts it out at 35 miles an hour. So he tried it with Rama, and Rama loved it, ears shaking, tail wagging. And so every Sunday, he started to paint with Rama. And, you know, they were doing this really wild, bright colors of hot pinks, blacks, and oranges. And the day that we were there, they did three colors of blue and a yellow and a red. And they were spraying, Rama would say, Jeb would say, Rama, beak or trunk, and then give him a little bit of paint. Rama would blast it, wash his own trunk, let the color do its thing on the vertical canvas. And then again with another color, and the colors started to blend in beautiful ways. It's a very powerful spray. I mean, humans have a spray brush that's not bigger than a magic marker.
Right.
He's got a 300-pound, you know, 6-foot trunk or 7-foot trunk. And so I got this full-body experience that I was meant to do an international traveling exhibition to awaken, like immediately awaken, a feeling of a sense of love, our innate love of life, which E.O. Wilson coined biophilia, this love of life that we all have.
Right.
And that this work would be powerful. And so I went up and I gave this lucid presentation to the keeper who ushered us in to see Jeb and Rama.
Right.
And I gave a more lucid, more detailed presentation. And I was listening just as they were listening in kind of amazement, like, well, that's amazing. And we're going to do this exhibition together. And then it took a year of letter writing to confirm this, you know, interaction myself as a project volunteer. And there I was with my Oregon Zoo shirt on a year later in the barn. And we painted together for 5 years, five summers.
Unreal.
Intensively. And it was a oneness like I would never experienced, I'm sure, again in my life.
Hard
of
to
a man.
Explain. Right.
Yeah, and the feeling of it, a man, a woman, and an endangered species animal working on behalf of life. Because the whole intention is get this elephant's art out of the barn. He had a solo show at the Mark Woolley Gallery in the Pearl District in Portland and sold out.
One of the most well-known artists in Portland. I mean, it was like when I read that,
yeah,
I was like, what? And not to mention a big fundraiser.
Yes, exactly. Over time, you
right,
know.
Right.
And so I realized that if I added the knowledge and feel of the color harmonies, watercolors, like greatly increased the size of the canvases, that extraordinary things would happen. But little did I know that what would happen in terms of the quality and the power and the sophistication of these abstracts would go so far beyond what anyone or what I could have ever imagined in their beauty and power. It's uncanny. And, you know, I'm the artist in residence at Four Seasons, and when people see these works, these are world travelers, they go, they're just stunned by their beauty. And each one, Gina, I know you've looked at the site, is completely different. Like completely, radically different than the one before. And each one is spectacular. They're
breathtaking.
And imagining.
I just have to interject that the website has the ability to draw you in with its beauty and its content and the words, but you really get a feel. So I want to ask you just literally from a technical...
Ooh, that's good.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's just every page is literally a work of art. So kudos on that. And I've looked at a lot of websites in my 10 years as Mrs. Green. But one of the things that I wanted to ask in terms of the process, since we don't have the blessing of a visual on a podcast, but so Rama would do what Rama does and paint the, you know, do his painting part. And then you would collaborate as putting the other, you know, some of like, there's one that I just love that has a tiger in it. I believe it's, I think it's a tiger. I couldn't get a close up of it, but what did you add to it to be this combined work of breathtaking art?
So we three worked as one. Jeb was the creative contact.
Yes.
Rama painted whatever he wanted, having a blast of his own volition, sometimes vertical. Later on in the process, we only did horizontal because it was so much easier for him to see and move that heavy trunk around. And he was on the floor, huge canvases, you know, 3 foot by 5 foot canvases, 4 by 6. The finished paintings are 5 feet by 7 feet once we check them out as Tonkas.
I've got to see
them. They're awesome. They're just, and the way, and Julia Fairchild, you know, mahalo to Julia. She is a homegrown, home crafted, self-taught webmaster. And she is very sensitive to my really refined and sometimes persnickety design sense, like move that down a 16th of an inch, please. And she also is the seamstress for the Rama exhibition. And when the World Conservation Congress came up and we had to use all organic or upcycled fabrics, which I wanted to do anyway, the bordering of these things, we were frequenting thrift shops to get ready for the world premiere at the IUCN World Conservation Congress last year. And they're just stunning. So I'm thanking Julia for that. And so I would get to choose the colors and I would study, like I have a sense of what species that I wanted to do, or is this desert or is it jungle or forest, or, and sometimes just for the beauty of the colors.
Right.
And so I got to design the colors and then the order that Rama got them. But it was in the moment, like these 10, 15, 20 minutes, like amazing art experiences with Rama, where I'd have to very quickly see what was happening, choose a color. And we all were just into it, like a total zoom laser focus. And Rama painted whatever he wanted. And from year to year, these paintings are very different. Like, you know, when I wanted that tiger that you mentioned, that was soft blend. I saw what he was doing and I went, I could make a rainbow out of this. And just by the order of the colors, he created this magical rainbow. And I love my golds, you know, from my illuminated manuscript days, my golds and my silvers. So Jeb would sometimes ask, Callie, can you have one painting without the bling?
Oh my gosh.
Gold or silver. And I just looked at him in all seriousness and said, no. So they all have. Because Rama could work with acrylics on top of the breath spray painting.
Right.
We would hand him a brush, a big brush, a house painting brush.
I just cannot believe it.
Work.
I cannot believe it.
Really high quality silver and golds and copper. Acrylics on top and the way it bled and blended. It was just like, I remember the first time I did a stain painting with Rama, it was like 4 by 5 feet. And the keepers were going, oh my God, Callie, what are you doing? This is so wet. I didn't prime the canvas. I just scrubbed it so it'd be really taut but natural. And loose watercolors so that, you know, mixed mineral, all safe watercolors. And Rama was just having a blast with this thing. And they're going, oh my gosh, it's so watery, so thin. And then at the very end, I handed Jeb the gold. And he got out of, I had all this ready in a bucket. And Rama did these calligraphic brush strokes. This is the Amur leopard background. Calligraphic, huge brush strokes in gold. And we stood back and the keeper said, now that's art.
Oh.
that is art.
Oh my gosh.
And it was so extraordinarily beautiful as to take people's breath away. And all for pointing out the beauty and fragility of nature. And there's always a place for me. There's always one place that's plain or calling out, like the giraffe one. There was literally the exact color and shape of a giraffe head there. And so there's always a place, and only meditation guides me. You know,
right,
I don't think through things. I could never have thought any of this up or any of the paintings. I mean, there's each one, Gina, has a story of synchronicity.
Rose's Dream. Talk about one that just absolutely drew me in. And I just have to say, when I read about Rose's Dream, which is a picture of Rama standing on top of the earth, I assume it's Rama. I don't know if it's Rama.
And it's Rose, his sister.
Rose. Oh. So you read the story.
Rose's sister.
Okay. And you understand that these are animals that, as far back, the African elephant, I think, was put on the endangered species list in 1978, and then 1986 more, and then 1996. And people, we're talking about a reduction of over 50% of these magnificent populations, and it's probably more. I, you know, put myself through the pain of watching what's happening so that they can get the tusks and the cruelty and the just the unbelievable behavior surrounding that. But I want to just integrate the thought of this is purposeful, intentional, consciousness-raising art, not just beautiful works of art that you can look and say, oh my gosh, there's such an incredible, important meaning and message when you look at each one of the pictures. And I want to say to people, go to theramaexhibition.com and plan on spending an hour there so you can read about the stories behind the pieces of art. All of them are gorgeous. The tiger picture, I can't tell. I can't even tell you what it means. Fare thee well, beloved. I mean, so that's the story. So go on. I digress,
right,
but it was like
men,
the emotional.
Two men cry.
Oh, I so believe it.
In front of that painting.
I so believe
it. They're very powerful.
Very, very, very
You're
powerful.
You're looking at the breath of an elephant, the mana and the power, the living breath of an elephant.
Yes.
Frozen into color. These paintings have power and mana. And then, you know, I'm just guided as to, well, that's what that is. And, you know, the beauty is the key in. And, for example, there's a painting, I absolutely love this painting. It's called Gyre, Swirling in a Sea of Plastic. And it's a very ethereal work that Rama was doing, soft edges, no edges, just soft blends, which didn't happen every year. Some year there were hard edges, there were like flower shapes. I mean, really different kind of techniques. And this painting is really beautiful. I didn't know what it was. And I brought it to Four Seasons and I started to paint because I want people to see this and these works and not just be holed up in my house studio. And I came across this German Aerospace Company's view of the Hawaiian Islands, which is why the World Conservation Congress with 10,000 conservation leaders from 192 nations were here on the islands last year, is because, as you likely know, we are, unfortunately, tragically, unspoken in a lot of circles, we are the endangerment capital of the world and the extinction capital of the world. And it's a tragedy how much we've lost in Hawaii and around the world. Species are disappearing at an alarming rate.
It's a huge, loud alarm bell. You just have to emphasize that we are really killing off species that we will never get to see ever, ever, ever again in record numbers. It shocks me what they're doing to
the hippos. That's the minor part.
Yes.
That we won't see them again, that's the minor part. The fact is that everything is interconnected in our biodiversity, that we are reliant. And if one species is going down, that affects the whole web of their ecosystem. You know,
we are part of one world, one planet. I mean, it's the interconnectedness needs to be understood more. I could not agree with you more. And we are coming up on the next break, which, when I talk to you before the show, and this is not uncommon for me, when I have a guest like you, what I'd like to do in my world is to have a show that's going to go on as long as we feel like it and have it turn into a marathon.
But there's so much to say.
Oh my gosh, there's so much to say. So everybody stay here with us. More when we come back. Callie and Rama, the artist and the artist elephant, and Jeb Barsh. We need to talk about his magnificent contribution. Everybody stay here with me.
Absolutely.
We'll be right back.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks so much for joining us for this hour with Callie O'Neill. She's a prolific artist. I have said many glowing things about her, and what I really want to do is invite you to go to Callie, and I think it's important that I spell it. It's C-A-L-L-E-Y, O'Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, .com to learn more about her, and then go to the Rama Exhibition .com to just spend some wonderful time. Look at every painting. Every painting you'll want to spend time with and read about, and your life will be enriched. They're clever, they're fun, they're beautiful. There's messages, the depth. I mean, Callie, when I was looking at them, I mean, I want that one. I want that one. No, I want that one.
It's like, oh, they're just,
I mean, and that is, you know me well enough to know that is so heartfelt. You just click on the next one and you're like, oh my goodness. If you are a lover of animals and a respecter of the planet, you'll have the same experience as I do, from everything to honeybees, to bears, to turtles, just breathtaking. So I just want to reiterate that I hope people caught it, that Rama wanted to paint. That part to me is phenomenal in and of itself, and enjoyed it. It wasn't something that Jeb made Rama do. It was a beautiful partnership, and then enter Callie O'Neill that's going to share it with all the world. And the name of the exhibition is An Epic Journey of Art and Soul for the Earth, an international traveling exhibition of endangered species dedicated to the children of the world by Callie O'Neill with Rama the Elephant. So it's a big, big vision and a big, big intentional impact. So let's talk a little bit about the exhibit and how the timeline. I mean, it's like 5 years for the big unveiling. It was in September of 2016?
Yes. Actually,
a month
was
before
10
I met
years.
You. What's up with that?
Like right. me.
10 years.
I'm so glad this work needs to get out there.
Right.
And that was actually 10 years
of
in the
work.
Working. And before I do that, may I have your permission to track back to a thread I dropped
yes,
in the middle?
Absolutely. Like
so
I said before, there's no rules on Mrs. Green's World.
So very briefly, I was talking about the plastics painting, the gyre
right,
painting.
Right, yes.
That I had painted these Hawaiian islands as seen exactly above and below, not made up, from the permission I got from a German aerospace company to paint from their extraordinary, you know, view of the main Hawaiian islands, this endangerment capital of the world. And not knowing what this painting was really going to be about, I went in the former, not this past year, which was amazing, the Waimea Ocean Film Festival. People really ought to travel to Hawaii for this most extraordinary film festival. And I watched, we just watched this year, A Plastic Sea. And then before that, I will think of the name of that film in a minute. But anyway, it was a movie on plastics in the ocean. And I came back from that movie by Angela Sun. And I looked at this beautiful ethereal sky and sea by Rama and these islands that I had painted for weeks. And I went, oh my God, I have to paint plastic garbage as the border.
That's what this painting is about. You are kidding. And
plastics. And I looked at it and I was so sad. I was almost crying all the way back from the theater to my easel, my pop-up studio. And I went, oh my God, I have to paint plastic on the ocean on this beautiful painting. And that's what's real. These paintings, the beauty and the power is meant to bring people. People get into the painting and then they're already inside and then they see the border. And they go, it's like a startling thing. And it's garbage from Midway Atoll and plastic bottles, of which we want to use plastics. We have to get rid of immediately, completely.
Yeah, which
we've
is
taken
so,
the most,
so doable. It's so doable. And why don't we do it?
Immediately doable.
Hawaii's doing a lot, though. I mean, they were the first state to ban plastic bags. I mean, they knew. I visited Hawaii, went to Maui and met with their environmental leadership. And they said the way they got people to ban the plastic bags is because it was hurting tourism. The island was getting ugly for where all the plastic was gathering on the end of one of the beaches. So go ahead. I don't want to take any time away from you with Mrs. Green's World editorial comments. Ocean Gyres, Swirling in a Sea of Plastic is the name of that painting, in case people want to just look at that.
Yeah, check that painting out. It's amazing.
It's all amazing.
From guidance.
It is amazing.
I don't take credit for any of it, but we took an indestructible material and made it into disposable things that people go and they get a little bag and from Subway or wherever, and they put it in the garbage right outside the store. You know, anyway, we took an indestructible material and we turned it into disposable. It's unfathomable. But that's the key. That's the power of this work, for which I can barely take credit except as the hands of skill, due diligence, and amazing dedication and hard work. And really, I have Jeb Barsh to thank for this. Jeb Barsh is an amazingly dedicated keeper. I mean, imagine a life as this dedicated keeper, zookeeper. He's working with rhinos. That's one of my next paintings. I'm hoping to work with Cisco Systems on that. They are dedicated to rhinos.
That is
many
great
other
to know.
Businesses and corporations.
Sounds like part two show.
Yeah, because, you know, I've been doing this alone without a benefactor or any support. And so that's why, please do buy up all those ones you want, Gina. You know, that's what has to happen is millions of these posters, like millions, because they have this power and message to put this out there. I've been asked by several pangolin activists now to do a pangolin piece, a shark piece. I'm working on an amazing frog piece with Thomas Morent and the photographer, hopefully Robin Moore. So they're all, many of them are integrations too, which I want to credit all the wildlife photographers with immense patience and those who have collaborated with us. So you can please contact me too if you're an extraordinary wildlife photographer of endangered species. And Jeb Barsh, this keeper, saw this in Rama that he needed to thrive and that this was the way, and dedicated every Sunday morning. They were painting for 4 years before I met Jeb. So he created this, his seeing, you know, his intuition, his guidance. I mean, this was a triple match of, like, Jeb is my beloved creative partner,
yes,
as was Rama.
It was so clear.
And they were brothers.
In your writing. Yes, it was so clear. It was like this bond was impenetrable. It was a wonderful part of the story to read and learn about.
Oh, thank you so much. So I thank Jebby, who's, you know, like, just amazing man and a wild man and hilariously funny, for caring that much. And he saw that, you know, this work could indeed and should indeed, you know, reach out into the world. Because we're still losing habitat.
Right.
You know, we're in the middle of a massive extinction crisis, which threatens our survival. And believe me, I am an optimist. We are going to solve this. I mean, we still have, before we go into overshoot and collapse or global weirding with climate, we have this minute. And as Barack Obama said in his extraordinary farewell speech last night, if you don't like it, why complain? strap your boots on and do something.
Change it.
For your own ecosystem.
I got
goosebumps. Make a change. Run for office,
right,
he said.
Right.
Go run
right.
for office. Just don't complain anymore. We don't have time for that. At the Waimea Ocean Film Festival, we saw an amazing movie, which I want to highly recommend to everyone. It's called Merchants of Doubt. Maybe you could interview the folks that made that movie.
I'm writing it down. Merchants of Doubt.
They are. Merchants of Doubt. And the same spin doctors that spun a web around tobacco and lied to the people have created the climate change debacle that has wasted 35 years. And the thing is that after 50 years, the tobacco guys were forced by law to say, yep, we totally lied. We knew the whole time that we were going to kill cause cancer.
Right.
And now we have to admit it. But we don't have 50 more years for climate change. We've already wasted 35. And that's a huge aspect of losing species. I mean, I don't think we should have called it carbon. We should just call it hot, black, dirty, blanketed pollution. It's air pollution, plastic pollution. I mean, so then the invasive species that we have, that, you know, the population is starting to taper off. You know, like we only have two hands. You know, my daughter used to say, Mama, what about having another baby? It's like I said, Leanna, how many hands does Mama have? And she said, two. I said, how many hips does Mama have to hold a baby? And she said, two. And that's it. Two.
Oh.
You know?
Yeah.
And to be optimistic that thoughts change reality, and that if we can all join E.O. Wilson, who, guess what, Gina, I'm ecstatic to say, I met four times E.O. Wilson,
you
my great hero
me.
Of fame. Guess what? I'm really just proud of and honored and thrilled that there's going to be one color plate in Professor Wilson's next book, and it's going to be one of the Rama paintings.
Oh, my gosh. That is, what an honor.
I'm so honored.
It's
the frontispiece, and I'm talking to E.O. Wilson about the Rama exhibition by another name, such as Half Earth, or, you know, the Half Earth Cathedral,
right.
or Half the Earth
right.
for the Rest of Life. Two, we have in the Rama exhibition, we are diving in completely to the Half Earth Project. And I want to ask all you listeners and all of your friends and all of your social media people to please go and buy Half Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life by Edward O. Wilson. So we are wanting to team up with Edward Wilson so that the Rama exhibition, of course, by another name that he would choose, be a place, a well-known place within the E.O. Wilson Biodiversity Foundation.
This is just an idea, a proposal I put forth. Yeah, let's share with people who he is, because I don't think everybody is familiar with his work. And I can wax poetic about him. He's a biologist, he's a researcher, he's a naturalist. He's probably he is the preeminent scientist in this field, and an amazing, amazing human being. I cannot believe you got to meet him. Do you think you could help me get him on the show?
That would be nice. I will do my level best.
I mean,
he's amazing, and I'm working with him
he
now.
He is amazing.
And he's 85 years old. I'll apologize to Ed if he's younger. And he wanted to be an ornithologist, had a fly fishing accident and couldn't do that. He became an entomologist. He's a famed Harvard professor emeritus. He created the term biodiversity, which we need that term to be as commonly held.
Yes, we do. We need to talk about it in this show and what that means.
We must.
It's so incredibly important.
This is life on Earth. We're losing life on Earth. That is the most important thing going on right now. And that we save life on Earth by what we do in our bodies, our homes, our backyards, our neighborhoods, and our communities, our watershed. And so Half Earth is E.O. Wilson's project. It's a goal. It's something every person wants to get behind this. And it is the worst thing that ever happened to nature was the ignorance politicizing of quote-unquote environmentalism.
Right.
That is not, this is not a political football.
It isn't.
There's nothing
it
political
isn't. It
about
isn't.
Saving
it
life on Earth.
I know. We have to keep emphasizing that and build bridges and collaborate. You know, I want to read one quote about biodiversity that I also picked up from the amazing website. Biodiversity is the totality of all inherited variation in the life forms of Earth, of which we are one species. We are one species. We study and save it to our great benefit. We ignore it and degrade it to our great peril. It's like the warning bell. I too am an optimist, but there are times when I feel I sound like an alarmist, but we don't have forever. I mean, people need to get engaged and put that engagement in high gear. And I quite frankly believe that one of the ways to inspire them is by visiting your website and by visiting the Rama exhibition website. And I mean that sincerely, because art speaks to us in such a very different way, as you well know. I am a different kind of artist, hopefully as a word steward, but what you're, the pictures, it's just common ground, it's common beauty, it's common love of nature that gets deeply into our souls about that. And that's what happened to me. I got, like I said, down the rabbit hole on the website, almost to the expense of, oh, I have to write questions for the show. And then I just took a deep breath and knew that the show was going to unfold exactly as it should. So I said, okay, you just need to take a deep breath and let Callie share the story of her journey about with Rama and Jeb, and the beauty will unfold all on its own. You don't have to have a list of questions, but I do. I have like another 2 pages, but it's okay. We're not going to get to them. So let's.
I would be happy to come back because I agree. I mean, and this is the time for everyone's art to become powerful.
Yes,
and
art
quite
is
frankly,
power.
You know, I don't want to sound in any way arrogant about this because, all due respect to all artists, it takes an awakening, an ecological awakening, and we are not an eco literate society.
Right.
I mean, eco literacy is at a low ebb, but once we are, let every song, every poem, every painting, sculpture, park have at its root saving half the earth for the rest of life. This is doable. E.O. Wilson and team, the foundation, Paula Ehrlich, his CEO and president at the E.O. Wilson Biodiversity Foundation, they are putting this out to the world. It's showing up everywhere. It's on the cover of Sierra Club magazine. I heard Inger Anderson, the deputy general of the IUCN, where I was so blessed to be the featured conservation artist, talk
what
about, like,
honor.
We really have to consider this. Thank you. I was so deeply honored. 10,000 square feet of space with 10,000 conservation leaders. And they all know, people are now saying, E.O. Wilson turned to me and said, it will be art that exponentially expands the reach of this knowledge. So if it's just decorative, if the song says nothing, you know, it's time to deepen the meaning, because it can be fun and danceable and positive, as so many artists are now, like Medicine for the People and
right.
Mike Love and Elijah Ray and so many other like artists that are, you know,
yes.
Enough already of the complaining and how bad it was. Let's put forth something for the youth that they can feel like there is work for everyone, highly dignified, abundant and prosperous work for everyone, rebuilding, you know,
yeah,
our
let's get
world.
Engaged. Yes. And we have about a minute and a half left. And I want to again repeat that I invite all of our listeners to go to Callie O'Neill. If you don't have the spelling, I'm not going to spell it again, but you can get it. It's C-A-L-L-E-Y. Just put that in O'Neill and it'll come up, believe me. And then the Rama exhibition. It's theramaexhibition.com. And I want to...
Or theramaexhibition.org.
.org, okay.
Therama, R-A-M-A, exhibition.org.
Either one of them work.
Google the Rama exhibition,
yeah.
It'll come right up.
Yes. Next week, we have a great show with Lisa Lavallo from Cox Communications. Big impact with zero waste. Cox and the Cox Foundation are doing amazing things for the environment around our country. And our Mrs. Greensworld show on Saturday will be Steve Feldman, a renovation angel, and I can't wait for you to meet this renovation angel. His story is another one that's compelling. Callie, thank you so much for taking the time. It is my intention for our paths to cross, hopefully in Hawaii, but if not, Tucson, Arizona is good enough for me. Everybody, make it a great green week, and thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World.